Hello and welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast for the week of the 30th of April 2015. This is your weekly review of all things cycling. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, we're talking Larayen, another win for that man Valverde. Are motorised bikes really worth fearing in the modern peloton? I know that's not a joke. And as racing rolls on in Turkey and Romandy, we discuss Cavendish's resurgence, a guy called Rebellion, and some other stuff which we'll go into all a bit later. And with me, after the gentlest of absences, it's Philip Gomes who returns. Phil, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Electrified.
Electrified, and of course, the one and only Ride Media's Rob Arnold. Rob, good to see you.
Thanks for having me back once again.
Always a pleasure, always
Thursday
a pleasure.
Thursday regular.
We're actually at a later time slot, so hopefully everyone's, you know, got their extra bit of rest.
But we're not live, so it's okay for the audience.
Well, yeah, the audience can listen to it whenever they want, but we're recording a bit later, so that's obviously going to deeply affect the entire podcast.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
We've had one extra cup of coffee.
As we mentioned last week, Tanny is away for the next 6 weeks. He is on a well-earned vacance.
Thank Christ. I couldn't wait for that guy to go.
Yeah, exactly. I think you speak for all.
Yeah. How was the response to commentary about Anthony Tanz as a commentator? Did we get much feedback?
No.
Not last week. The week before, we got a lot about... we were talking about something.
Disc brakes.
Yeah.
Disc brakes always generate conversation.
No, but look, actually, you know, it. I guess in some ways it's hard to communicate technological type stuff on audio or radio.
Yeah.
Because you don't have pictures, but it's still an interesting topic. And I think people are engaged in that sort of thing. They're interested in things like disc brakes.
Mm. I'll be interested to see what
single chain rings. Right, yeah. We chucked up a quick GCN clip the other day on the website about the new SRAM single chainring thing, and you know it got good reaction. People are interested.
I think I saw a comment on that, which was something like, "Good to see that we're, you know, as technology advances, we're regressing."
but actually, that's the thing, right? As technology advances, what you can hide complexity, right? And feature simplicity. I think this is the nature of, say, Apple devices, for example. You know, they're incredibly complex devices, but they're incredibly simple in terms of design. And a lot of what happens with them is hidden in the background. And I don't see why that should be any different for cycling technology.
Well, what's cool about cycling tech is that it's endless. You think you've reached the pinnacle, and then something new comes up, like this new wireless shifting that's coming up. That's going to be a great thing, great innovation.
Yeah. Exciting times.
People always get off on any sort of tech story, so it's not surprising that disc brakes got discussion. And hopefully it'll be the same after we talk about the motorised bike question in the peloton and the UCI's reaction.
So in Anthony Tan's absence, we'll just put a disc brake or a caliper on the chair.
Yes.
And just take a photo of it.
It'll get more coverage. Is that what you're saying? Is that what the outcome of that little...
No. We'll have more conversation around it.
Not at all. Wasn't what I was saying at all. All right, guys, let's talk about Liège, Bastogne-Liège. Harry? Well, last Sunday, the final of the Ardennes Classics, Liège, Bastogne-Liège, was won by Alejandro Valverde. He's done it before, he's done it again. And he did it on Sunday. The highlight for me, though, was the look of Joaquin Rodriguez, look on his face as Valverde crossed the line ahead of him. Something times you feel that J-Rod is living some sort of Groundhog Day like hell, where he simply has to go through the same agony again and again. Anyway, Frenchman was second. That was Julian Alaphilippe,
to know this name by the end of the year. We know it already.
We know it already
after a couple of great results. And Joaquin Rodriguez, who I just mentioned, was third. It ended in a largish group. It's kind of almost been a theme. I know there's been little movements off it when Dan Martin won. He was just escaped. But 10 or so, that seems to be the number that arrives at Liège with a difference in the order. Guys, what were your initial thoughts? Did you watch Rob on Sunday, the SBS broadcast?
Yeah,
what did you think?
It was a good race. I think it's a much more enjoyable one to watch than Flesh Wallonne, because we know the sequence of Flesh Wallonne, even though that's the preceding Wednesday, and that's an Ardennes race, and we know how it works, and there's the Mudahi, and we know that Valverde is going to win if he's there, like he did. It did feel like Valverde was going to win, but I have to admit that when Bardet did his little attack probably 5 or 6 kilometres from the finish, this is Romain Bardet from AG2R, I just thought he was sort of my dark horse. I'd sort of hoped that he might show some form and upset the apple cart a bit. But we saw the Spaniards, Daniel Moreno, Rodriguez, Valverde. There were numbers as well from each of their teams. Mm. Moreno and Rodriguez are in the same team. But it was a good race, but it lacked that surprise at the finish, other than Alaphilippe, who I just think I really like to start saying his name more and more.
Well, we'll talk about Alaphilippe in a bit more moment, because we've got some stuff. I think we should flesh him out a bit more. But yeah. Phil...
He was 13 when Valverde first won. Yeah. And it wasn't terribly long ago.
No.
He's still 22. Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about him later.
He's very young. Phil, I mean, your thoughts. I mean, one thing, I suppose, for an Australian audience was... bit of bad luck for Gero. He must have run over a couple of black cats.
End of last year, during the off season. What's the deal, man? You know, one of the things that's marked Gero's career over the years is that, you know, he has a certain kind of consistency. And
he was OGE's insurance.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
he kept winning when they had nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, but the good thing is now is we've got the team has a fine young crop of riders who are starting to make themselves felt. So, okay, yeah, we feel for Gero, and we do feel for Gero, because even on a bad day in a race like Liège, you know, he's the kind of guy who could be present at the front, right, even if he didn't win. Which I don't think he was going to win, but there's still the chance that he would have been there, at least with that select group in the finish.
In some sort of bizarre...
Valverde wins, Gerrans is nearby.
He's usually there.
So, yeah, like, right. Valverde won. Last year, Gerrans won, Valverde was runner-up.
That's right.
So, Willunga Hill.
But the good thing for Gero is that he wasn't badly injured in any way, and that he'll be fine. And look, you know, the team still has the two Grand Tours coming up, and they're going to feature pretty strongly in both, I reckon.
It's amazing, though, your point, Phil, just about the consistency of Gerrans. Because if you think, okay, yeah, this year has been an absolute shocker for him, and not of his own doing. It crashes sometimes. It just the way the cookie crumbles. But in terms of this year versus, say, 2012, if Gerrans hadn't have been that absolute talismanic force for OGE, their team would have had absolutely nothing. So... it's interesting that now they do actually have, you're right, they've got other riders who are underwriting it, and it is almost making the Gerrans loss feel at least a little bit more subdued.
Yeah, the blows are softened.
Yeah, indeed. Slightly. Indeed. Guys, so. Alejandro Valverde, he's a guy that disposes divisive, and he won the Flèche Wallonne. He won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and so he's done the double, he's done it before. Andrew Hood, a Villeneuve journalist, wrote a good article. I don't know if you read it.
No.
But basically talking about how we should receive, you know, Alejandro Valverde's wins because of the fact that there is this ongoing spectre over his past, and he never has totally fronted up about it. I know he served a ban, but there's this. It's an awkward thing.
But you read that little piss take I wrote on the website.
Yeah,
you know, how to watch Alejandro Valverde win a bike race, and it was really touching on that, because every time he's at the head of a race or he wins a race, we see the same old arguments trotted out. Now, to be quite honest, I'm really bloody tired of him. Okay, I want to watch some bike racing. I understand his past. I understand that it comes with a qualification, but at the same time, I have always enjoyed watching him race.
Mm.
Doping era, non-doping era, today. He's still a fantastic bike rider. He's been a bike rider since he's been a great bike rider since he was a kid. This guy is not, he's not a plonker. He's not a donkey made into a racehorse. Valverde's always been a racehorse.
Mm.
That's the thing.
Mm.
Right? So at the same time, while understanding that he has a past and maybe, you know, being annoyed that he hasn't, fully really come clean with us about what his past is, at the same time, I'm still going to sit there and I'm going to enjoy watching him ride a bike.
Mm.
You, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy watching him ride because he does animate the race. It's not a formula for him. We saw in Liège, for example, he was the one who bridged the gap to Moreno. He was the one who instigated the sprint. He was the one who won the sprint. He was the one who thanked his teammates. He was the one who was very diplomatic afterwards. He did all of the right things. So, you know, look, if he's doing blood passport like everyone else has to, and he's doing all of the rigmarole that he needs to do to be able to be a bike rider again in his comeback, then... you know, we have to enjoy watching him ride. But at the same time, when I, you know, you get that adrenaline when they're on the La Redoute, and that stays with you all the way to the finish in Liège. And then it gets to the finish and you see Valverde win and you think, okay, I'm going to bed. You know, you're not like, oh, I'm going to sit around and see what he has to say. Or it's okay.
It's almost like, I think there's a butterflies in your stomach moment, because it's kind of like...
can someone please just... I think people would prefer to see him beaten than to see him winning. That's just sort of a generic non-Spanish perspective, perhaps. I don't know.
But then at the same time, well, the other Spanish perspective is that, you know, we would all have enjoyed watching Perito cry on the top step.
The finishing shots of Liège are generally pretty boring, but this one's spectacular because you've got Alaphilippe smashing his handlebars, and you say, you can see the look of just defeat in everyone else who was within a shot of the title.
Yep.
They were all like, we knew that we had to mark Valverde. We knew we had to mark Valverde, and he got us.
Yep.
He still did it.
And I tweeted that, like, what, 10, 15K out. I went, haven't seen anything yet that doesn't end with a Valverde win.
Yeah. Mm. And, right? You're basically Nostradamus, Phil. Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm not blowing my own horn. I'm just, you know, it's just like...
No.
You're right. There was an air of inevitability to it. Now, and that contrasts to when... Katusha...
Alexander Kristoff.
No, not Kristoff. His teammate, the bearded one.
Paolini.
Paolini, yeah. When Luca Paolini won.
The
bearded one. Sorry, guys. I just had a bit of a...
You're actually nursing a bit of...
brain fade there.
Quite a bit of facial.
Yeah, yeah. I'm actually styling up for Luca. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's funny because in that race that Paolini won, you know, it had the same air of inevitability, but it was ultimately far more exciting in the finish.
Yeah. Well, I think even just the fact that SBS has been broadcasting all of the major classics this year, and there's been the hashtag of SBS Cycling, which I've been joining in on and watching the commentary.
Mm-hmm.
It's the evolution in recent times is remarkable on how the classics are being watched, because it is much more interactive than ever before. You know, I keep every time the classics roll around, and I've been making my magazine 17 or 18 years, we've run the sequence of the classics, Milan-San Remo through to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and there's a reason, because they're monuments of cycling and they deserve to get coverage.
And there's a narrative there.
But when we started, when I started doing it, I was watching them on VHSs that had been sent over from friends living in Holland. You could not get the coverage live here. And now that it's live, people understand that Valverde can do this. They offer commentary on many forms of social media. And we understanding the race because we see it live.
Yeah, and if I can expand on that, right? We had incredibly strong numbers for broadcast TV numbers and also streaming online numbers, better than we've ever had before.
Bearing in mind it finished at 1 o'clock in
yes,
the morning.
Yes, better than we've ever had before. Mm. So strong growth. Some of the races were 50, 60, 70. I think one of the races was 100-something% audience increase for us. So clearly what's happened now is that as the Australian audience becomes more exposed to the entire arc of the classics from Milan-San Remo,
willing to invest
in the whole story, because as you said, it is a narrative,
mm-hmm.
right? It's almost like this lovely little mini season within the season itself that attracts a different type of racing. And the thing that I like about it, it's almost like because these races come almost week after week after week, it's almost like a football season in a way, where you've got a fixture and the fixture's on this weekend, which goes back to what the UCI has in mind when it comes to a restructure of the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it makes the point, right, that we can't have weekends where there is a multiplicity of focus, like, there, you know, everybody is distracted with a number of different races. What this proves to me is that approach of having a single event on a single weekend, right, that kind of focus really works. We've seen it on our ratings. We've seen the audience response. We've seen it in social media, where as people become accustomed to seeing these fixtures happen week after week, they're willing to invest their time in the same way that they would to watch the football codes on a Sunday afternoon, AFL, AR, NRL, et cetera, because those fixtures come about in a logical way, which is at odds with the rest of the calendar, which is seemingly totally random.
Yeah. I mean, the classics is like a mini season, isn't it? So you sort of get the sense of how it's building up, and then you get to the end point and you go, oh, okay, I got the whole thing, and I know who should be the favorites.
The fact that it is being broadcast in Australia live is testament to the changing culture of cycling.
Yep.
And because we've done now all of the classics have been broadcast and we've seen them and we've watched them, the review that we do in the magazine has to be different. And we had someone attend this a trilogy. So it was from Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix and Amstel Gold, and they referenced what the atmosphere was like in the crowd. And he, in Roubaix, for example, made the observation that a large portion of the people on the side of the road were Turk, Turkish immigrants or Arabs or different people from different cultures, and they were all thrilled to see this race that is so historic in French culture, but there weren't a lot of French spectators.
Mm.
And so, okay, cycling's attracting the Australian audience, I think is my point, and it's pulling in what were people from once Antipodean cycling nations. But it's happening in the heartland of cycling as well, where it's introducing new people to the sport. And it's just something that I hadn't ever considered before, but to stand in the crowd and see it unfold and hear all the various accents is something that it's a pleasure to be able to report on.
Yeah, for sure. We mentioned we'd talk about him, and I think we will now. Julian Alaphilippe, this is the Omega Fire. Keep doing that. ETX Quickstep rider, 22 years, as you mentioned, Rob. He's runner-up at Liège, runner-up at Flèche Wallonne only a few days before. What? He was even top 10 at Amstel Gold. So he's had a very good Ardennes for someone as young as he is. And what was I doing when I was 22? Is that what you're going to say, Phil?
No. I was just about to add some snark.
Yeah, well, by all means, go on.
He's the ultimate ETX Quickstep rider, finishing second or third in everything.
Well, that's right. He's a consummate ETX rider. But, you know, this guy is he's a Tour de l'Avenir stage winner. He's got a big future ahead of him. Former cross rider as well, Fabio Aru. How far can this guy go, do you reckon? I mean, he's really come on the radar in a big way in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to defer to Rob on this because, as you say, he's only really come on my radar in the last 6 months.
Last week I said I thought he was Colombian. I'm so embarrassed. Like, I can't swallow that. I spat it out. I don't know why I said it.
I think you said that you felt like he should be Colombian because his name was kind of that...
Julian
Alaphilippe. I mean, it's got a bit of a...
Arredondo.
Anyway, yeah. Well, that's moving. What can he do? He's 62 kilos of determination and absolute finesse because... We saw Stibar, for example, on Sunday in Liège doing a big job, and Sherwin, I think, was calling it, and he kept talking about it as though Stibar was trying to win the race, and it seemed fairly obvious to me that he was setting it up for Kwiatkowski, yep. Who was on the podium last year, or for the big surprise of the season, and that's what we have to categorise him as. He's the surprise of the season, the revelation, a superstar. I think... There would have been a lot more adrenaline for longer after the win had he come first. I think, you know, we would have been, what's he going to say? We want to know more about this guy. And I think, but that's time's going to come. I think the French now have to just put the brakes on, not put the pressure on him like they do for all the young guys.
Thibaut Pinot, Ramon Bardet.
Yeah. But I think they all will handle it in their own certain grace. Okay, Thibaut Pinot had a lost season in between the successful debut in the Tour de France in 2012 and then last year's smashing ride.
Mm.
Bardet is managing it well. He's. I've got big rap
consummate
on this
professional.
Guy. I keep talking about him. I just think he's fabulous. I just to see him up in whatever he was, fifth or sixth in Liège, made me happy.
Mm-hmm.
But what am I talking about?
I guess
the way that the French
build in
the French public need a champion is going to put has put pressure on Pinot in the past that he didn't deal with very well. Bardet's managing it the way that he does.
Roland was another example of a guy that was hit by it and
into
then...
ego machine. Like was, you know, at the big jump once he won the white jersey in the Tour de France, he became a different person. Let's just hope that Alaphilippe has got the right instruction and being on a Belgian team is going to help enormously because he's...
You don't get too carried away with...
all the others that I've referenced are on French teams, so maybe that's going to help him a little bit. But I don't know, I think... It's going to be interesting what becomes of him. Hopefully he's a GC rider.
I think he's certainly got classics abilities, but, you know, we've seen, if we look at some of his other results, he did very well at the Tour de Land fourth overall last year. So that's not a bad result for a potential GC rider. I think one of the Yates brothers did very well at that. So
he is in the lead up. When you're young, you can pick up results along the way. And I think second in Flèche Wallonne is hugely different to second in Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Mm.
Okay, similar terrain, similar part of the world. But it's that extra 60, 70 kilometres that makes a big difference on young legs.
Oh, no, I mean, Flèche Wallonne is, I wouldn't say you can fluke a Flèche Wallonne, but the nature of the finish means that if you find yourself in the right place, we talked about this a bit last week, I think you can sort of nab a result because it really is so much about being that top 20. I think Liège is, a race where total attrition, full gas, and if you're even in that lead group, you know, if he had been top five, top 10, we still would be giving him praise. as we did for Romain Bardet. Guys, let's move on from Liège-Bastogne-Liège. For everyone who is following along at home, to anyone that missed the race, you can find highlights of Liège online on the SBS and on the SBS On Demand website. That's it for Liège for now. Well, the UCI has introduced new sanctions for motorised doping that includes a minimum suspension of 6 months for riders and teams found guilty of an offence, as well as fines of up to 1 million Swiss francs. According to Brian Cookson, the president of the UCI, he says the UCI takes the issue of technological doping, such as the ability to use hidden motors, very seriously. The Cycling Independent Reform Commission, CIRC, report only confirmed the need to act decisively. There was also an article on Cycling Tips by Matt Deneef talking about the nature of this technology and how it works. And it's amazing how small and subtle a lot of it can be. You can be in a bid-on cage, something the size of, I don't know, I don't even know what that'd be, a watch, basically. But it can add up about 100 watts, they're sort of saying. 100 watts is about the estimate. Bursts of 2 hours, 1 to 2 hours, could have a substantial impact. And we have talked about this before. I think there was a crazy video with Fabian Cancellara a few years ago where they were like, oh, he's definitely motorized doping. But the fact that the UCI, Phil, maybe I'll throw to you first, but the fact that the UCI has actually released something to amend their constitution and add sanctions to it, they are taking it seriously. I mean, how seriously should they be taking it? Is this something that actually should be feared? Or
well, I wouldn't say feared, but, you know, it's obvious, it seems to me that there's some intelligence out there. But at the same time, I think it's more a case of them just trying to get in front of some technological possibilities. Because, of course, we have to remember that that's the UCI's ultimate role, isn't it? It's always been sort of like the arbiter of what constitutes a bicycle. And it's been it defines the technology in the sport. And this is no different for me when I see it. So in many ways, it's just anticipating the revolutionary changes in technology that we're experiencing right now today. Mm. I think it's better that they get in front of it. And I think some of the more fevered imaginations out there on, you know, blogs elsewhere may want to blow the story up into it being something more than it really is at the moment. But, you know, maybe the UCI is just being extra cautious. And really, you know, there's been some contrast made with doping as well, and saying, you know, people saying, well, why aren't they spending as much time on, you know, on doping itself? And, well, I mean, come on, the UCI actually does. You know, they spend a tremendous amount of money on this problem. So this is a minor thing. They're just making sure that they're keeping on their toes, and that's their job.
I think there's so many bigger issues to look out for. Okay, look, to be honest, if someone dopes with a bike, they're just, I can't even conjure the name for them.
You can
just
say
go
dick.
Away. You know,
you can say
like
dick.
Just. But maybe at the elite level, they're doing this to bring it into the public eye, so that the people who are doing club races, who may be tempted, realise that it's really, really wrong. But surely anyone who even considers it realises it's completely wrong. Like, where's the glory in sticking a needle in your arm full of EPO and winning a race? Where's the glory in winning with a motor on your bike? What's the point?
Sort
of fool does that?
You know, it's funny because I actually think that, and this is just a personal opinion here and personal take, I would imagine that people who would consider something like EPO or cortisone would actually not necessarily think of doing something like this, because they would put those in some sort of, you know, okay, well, I'm doing all the things for my body because I still want to ride the bike. And almost as if putting a motor on your bike, it would actually be considered cheap.
It's a different sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sort of changed the nature of what you're doing.
So ludicrous. I remember the day Mick Rogers won the Tour de France last year, we were in the compound waiting for him to come out, and I saw the UCI scrutineers doing their x-rays, and they're prodding, they pull the saddle off, and they're prodding down the seat tube, and they're doing all this bits and pieces. And so I, of course, went to take photos, and I had my camera wrestled off me by security and was told, do not take a photo of this. So it was still sort of secret squirrel kind of activity. Like, here we are, we're doing these, and they'll take it behind a curtain to do their x-rays and do all of these things. So there was, since the Cancellara incident that you referenced a couple of years ago, there has been x-rays of bikes, and there has been a communique issued at most major bike races about there being no mechanical doping. And when you see that page, it's like, phew. No, it's not. It's not a relief. It's just, of course, there's bloody not. That's what I think. Like,
tell us what you really think, Rob.
No, I agree.
Honestly, UCI, here's a tip. Consider betting
yes.
as a problem
yep.
more than mechanical bikes. And I mean, mechanical bikes, the motorised bikes.
Yep.
Gambling in sport is a scourge that's going to be bigger than – that is bigger than doping.
Yes.
Yeah.
We talk about doping. When I asked Cookson what his views on the possibility of gambling influencing cycling, he looked at me with a vacant stare and told me straight up, I never considered it.
Yeah.
What the hell is going on? And are you not paying attention to what is being advertised on commercial television? Well,
is he not paying attention?
We know it's happening because we've had results where people have been basically passing money around. I mean, Kolob Nev and stuff. I mean,
that's a different cultural issue within cycling.
But the nature of buying wins is not far away from...
No, actual gambling.
Falling on your sword or... Yeah.
I don't want to make this conversation about gambling. I want to make the conversation less about motors and bikes. Like, yeah. this is just a publicity stunt. Like, okay, yeah. if it happens, whoever gets caught has to, I don't know what they're going to do with them. £1 million is minimum.
Well, yeah. but at the same time, whoever gets caught and the team that gets caught, let's assume that this something that does happen. What do you think the reaction of the fans will be? I think even more than doping, it would be just complete condemnation.
Yeah.
Right? Doping you can almost understand, but a motor, like you were saying, you know, a motor and a bike, it's like, that's a whole different level. That's just like, man, that's just like some serious cheating.
To be honest though, I think there's like it's a case of like the cart before the horse a little bit, because I feel like this was just something that was being joked about on social media. Like when it came from stuff like Cancellara, people going, oh, he's probably got a motor in his bike, and there was that sort of almost satirical video explaining how it would work. And then the way it sort of developed and people were just sort of joking around that, you know, that person must have a motor in their bike. And then the UCI just seems to have taken it more and more seriously. And yes, okay, it sounds like it's possible, but the difference between something being possible and something that actually is a possible threat seems...
Are they getting paranoid because there are batteries on bikes now? Like legitimate, batteries for electronic shifting?
Yes, that's right.
Is that what's breeding the paranoia?
I would have to say that that's part of it, because we can see as I mentioned right off the top. I mean, we can see that this incredible technological revolution that's happening all around the world in all manner of fields is happening to cycling now with this electronic shifting, et cetera. So, you know, look, I think the UCI is right to be aware and to investigate.
Let's just hope they don't go the other way and start, you know, that paranoia breeding the some regulation on non-inclusion of batteries. Because Shimano, for example, they did the DR2 that in 2008, been active and it's been facilitated well. But they're trying. Shimano would like their next iteration of their sport camera to include a longer-lasting battery, by one that uses the DI2 battery, for example.
Right, right, yeah.
The shifting battery.
Yeah, look, I mean...
So you're going to have cameras which are electronic, you're going to have shifting which is electronic, and is that why the UCI is being paranoid about the possibility of there being motorised bikes? I don't know.
Mm. I mean, you know what it explains, Rob? It explains how all those mysterious gear failures to the DI2 batteries being run down too early. I mean, that's the ultimate conspiracy, isn't it? Oh, I didn't charge it this morning. You know, I tell you what happened.
Hey.
I tell you what happened.
Hey, man. Yeah, it was
pushing your cranks around.
it was that third guy on the grassy knoll that did it.
Yeah, that's right. It was the third shooter. all right, let's move on. We could talk about that all day, but...
No, we couldn't. I think we all had consensus in the first sentence.
We did, you know.
It is dumb, but the fact that UCI is actually doing something about it seems almost... Well, I say in line with...
Hey, we're talking about professional cycling. One, we don't want to bet, and two, as we've seen in the past, there is nothing in professional cycling that is absurd.
Right.
Because when we think something is too absurd, it generally happens.
Nothing can surprise you.
No.
all right, let's move on. Thank you, Harry. Well, finally, quick look at the tours of Romandy and Turkey going on at the moment. I suppose they're the major races of the current season, just before the Giro d'Italia and the Tour of California. And then, of course, we head into Grand Tour mode, Giro, Tour, Vuelta. I can't believe it's already...
That's crazy.
It's already basically May. Well, by the time anyone listens to this, it probably will be May. A couple of things about the Tour of Turkey first up. One is that we've seen Big Cav getting some wins again after...
Cav versus Caleb. That's what we've been waiting for. The first appearance and what happens. Cav beats him by 10 centimetres, 15 centimetres maybe there was.
Yeah, but the bananas were the winner on the day.
Oh.
Did you see that photo?
No.
Didn't you see that?
No, I missed it.
He won. Cav ended up with a bunch of bananas that were as big as Caleb. Right, they looked seriously.
So not that big then.
Not that, well, Caleb's a little.
The finish shot is glorious because the pedaling sequence. Like I did a thing on Facebook saying similar pedal stance, similar height, similar
everything
position, similar determination, and the different. It's same but different. Mm. You know, Cavendish and Caleb are like cut from the same mold.
Twins.
But Cavendish got the better of him, and then Caleb faded. And
brothers from another mother.
Couple of days, but nonetheless, pretty cool to see.
But it's good to see. To be honest, I mean, Cavendish is a guy that we've almost forgotten in the first part of the season because he just hasn't been winning anywhere near as much as we've sort of come to expect. And I know it's only the Tour of Turkey, so we're not talking about the biggest race in the world, but people like Andre Greipel are there, Caleb Ewan is there. It's nice, I suppose, to get a little reminder that this guy isn't done yet, Phil. I mean, he's got legs to do some big things.
No, you can't rule Cav out of any sprint. Mm. I mean, that's the reality. So it's interesting. Greipel won overnight. In Turkey, right? So you know, it's interesting to watch.
And Jay McCarty's, you know, he got fourth the other day when Rebellin won. And
Davide. Well, yeah, I mean, Rob, you've brought us there, but yeah, Rebellin is the guy that we'll finish talking about Cav. But David Rebellin, guy that sort of continues to race despite the fact that, you know, you would have thought that he would have sort of quietly retired some years ago after that Sarah positive at the Beijing Olympics, but he's still just waddling around winning races, for example the Queen Stage of the Tour of Turkey, which, Phil, I think we've talked about this already, but not necessarily a good look for a race that seems to have ongoing problems with the credibility of its winners.
No.
I don't have anything to offer.
No, it's a funny
one. It goes on for a lot longer.
It does, yeah. Look, I mean...
Let's talk about McCarty instead of Rebellin.
All right, yeah. Up-and-coming young Australian.
Well, he never gets any coverage.
No. There are two Australians that never get any coverage. One is Jay, and the other one is David Tanner.
Yeah, we've referenced him a little because
he's been around a little bit longer.
Yeah.
But, you know, these are two guys that are plying their trade out in Europe at the moment, and McCarthy's at the younger end.
Mm.
So, you know, it's just interesting to see Australians just sort of out there. We know all the usual names. Mm. We see the usual names, but then there's these other guys out there that are really doing
and
solid work.
And he's on a top-tier team. He's with Tinkoff Saxo. Yeah. Let's just reiterate that. And I said to him at the start of last year at Tour Down Under, I look, sorry, mate, we haven't had you in the magazine. We haven't done an intro. And he said, no, that doesn't matter because I don't deserve one yet. I haven't done anything. Hmm. And I thought that was a kind of fresh attitude.
Yeah.
He's pretty. He's a pretty good guy to talk to. He's very humble, actually. And his head's definitely nowhere near as inflated as some of his contemporaries, which is... a nice change. You know, he's a Queenslander. He's kind of
chill,
very humble roots. And I don't think he's, you know, he's a good rider.
Mm.
We saw that at the under-23 championships in Holland, where he got just, you know, he did that. He was, I think he maybe launched the attack on the Kolberg.
Right.
So he's got talent.
He's flown under the radar. I think he signed with Bjarne Riis when Brad McGee was still working with him. And I said to Brad, "Oh, did you have a sway in it?" And he said, "Oh, no, I've never heard of him."
Yeah. Well, it might not have been McGee's last year was 2012 maybe or 2011
when Contador won the Vuelta.
13.
2012.
One of the times Contador won the World
Cup. But either way.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. He just got run down last night in the finish.
Again.
Yeah.
So that was 2 days in a row he had a crack.
2 days in a row he's had a shot at it. So
this is Tour of Turkey, by the way, just in case you've fallen.
The presidential Tour of Turkey. Phil, on Rabbi Ian, I know you don't want to talk about it, but I suppose the difficulty of similar to Valverde, in the sense that it's a guy that has been totally actually it's very similar to Valverde because it's a guy that not only was he caught, but he's been in no way repentant of his ways. And he's riding for a team which I suppose a lot of people would say is that under tier where you don't have a lot of faith in what's going on.
No.
There's not the same checks and balances as a higher tier team.
No. But at the same time, you know, in Rabin's defense, he's a known quantity. He's been around for a very, very long time. Doping or not, he's got phenomenal results throughout his career.
I don't think he's had enough. I don't think the Tifosi would be behind him quite as much as the Spanish fans are behind Valverde.
No. And I think it's interesting because the one thing Valverde has always had is the support of the movie star, Castiapagna, that whole historical management. He's always had their undeniable support. So no matter what happens to Valverde, he's always got a home. Mm-hmm. Whereas for somebody like Rabin, for example, and then he just gets dumped and we never hear of him again. And, you know, he's riding for a Polish team or some other, you know, ragtag mob somewhere in Europe. And, you know, we see that with quite a few guys. But it's interesting that with Valverde, you know, he's got believers.
I just really dislike the fact that Tour of Turkey has this mix of, you know, it's got world tour credentials in a lot of ways. You've got quite a few serious teams turning up. And then you've got all of these Asian teams. And I suppose by its nature, Turkey brings that sort of Middle Eastern, Asia-European mix. And, you know, we've seen people like Mustafa Sayer, was it Gabrowski? Mm-hmm. You know, we had a good winner last year in Adam Yates.
Yep.
But, you know, when these sort of things happen, it does huge damage, in my opinion, to the name of the race. You know, people go, oh, the Tour of Turkey, you know, oh, you won the Tour of Turkey, right, you know. You don't want that image to be associated with your race.
No. And look, to be fair to the race itself, they don't have any real control over this sort of thing.
Mm. They do to an extent.
To an extent, but with their invites.
They invited Sayers team the year after.
Okay, all right. You beat me there.
Let's talk about Dowsett. Is he going to beat Rowan's record?
Yes.
Let's talk about Sky versus OGE in the stage one of Tour of Romandie and beating them by 0.63 of a second.
That's more interesting than Rebellin. Let's just pass over. We're going to pass over Romandie very quickly, or
super quickly, but let's not paraphrase. In terms of Albasini or anything, but Giro d'Italia. It's the final real stage race before the Giro d'Italia. We've got Rigoberto Urán. He'll obviously be a contender in Italy.
We're going to talk about this next week.
We will. No, we'll do a proper preview then, and we'll be able to reflect on the last few stages of Romandie because it'll actually have happened. Michele Scarpone's there. Chris Froome's there. We'll get a good indication of how these guys are going. Obviously, Froome has won the last 2 years at Romandie, so this will be a good little gauge as to how he's going in terms of his season because, again, another guy that's really had a much quieter year, and I know that he had a couple of interruptions, but he, like Port, is just coming off this big block of altitude. So it'll be interesting to see how he's going. I mean, what are your thoughts on Romandie as a race, guys? Just quickly,
I kind of missed the short prologue that they used to have. That was just awesome fun. When I still have a vision of Pereira doing that. Anyway, I talked about that last year. The team time trials are going to be interesting equation in the races to come up, like the Giro begins with one, Giro d'Italia. Tour de France has one very late in stage 9. And we saw Sky beat Orica Green Edge by 0.63 of a second on the first stage of Romandie. And that in itself is cool because it's just that, to me, it's already building.
The rivalry is building.
But it's not.
You don't have that many TTTs in general in the year. So it's when you have these, it kind of does. You need them to build that because otherwise you don't have that Garmin HTC, Sky Green Edge. You don't have any of that because there's no history, you know. Yeah. I think we're sort of starting to get that Garmin.
I think when the UCI reintroduced or introduced the team time trial at the World Championships, I think that kicked off BMC Ethics. Sky, OGE, really, they want to win these things. And I think that really kicked off the rivalries and the intensity in these events. So we really look forward to them in the tours as well. Mm. So it's not just about making sure your GC rider is well placed in one of these tours. It seems that each of the teams treats the event as almost like a little self-contained rivalry within the race. They want to do better than the other team.
And it's a mini Tour de Suisse as well, because it is in Switzerland, but the actual Tour de Suisse isn't until June. Lots of mountains because it's in Switzerland. And we've got a lot of climbers turning up, so it'll be interesting to see how all that goes. Guys, maybe just quickly final thoughts. Phil, do you have any final thoughts on the week ahead?
It's just a form guide, right? I want to see how guys are going, how they're tracking.
Anything to watch out for on the Cycling Central website this week?
Not really. I mean, we're covering it, you know. Yeah. But it's hard to find a really good takeaway so far from the race, and I think we won't really have one until the end.
Yep. Rob, what about yourself? Any sort of crystal ball moments?
What I'm taking home from this week?
Mm. Yeah, looking ahead, I mean, what maybe people should look for?
I think we just get used to saying Richie Porte. You're going to have a week off this week, but as of the weekend after, it begins.
Richard Julian, I believe, is his full name?
Richie Porte. Richie Porte. It's a port for pink. Come on, let's get behind him, Australia.
Port for pink. I like that.
I might steal that
one.
We've been pushing at the hashtag port for pink.
Have you?
Yeah, but we're only in the small.
No,
numbers.
No, no. Okay, no.
Rob, you're aware that you can't do print hashtags. That doesn't make sense, right?
We'll run with that. Let's build on that.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Okay,
seriously.
One final thought I had actually was just on the subject of David Rebellin.
On the subject of David
Rebellin. No. I did remember it. It's the first Ride magazine I ever bought. So you'll like this, Rob.
Yes.
The back ad was David Rebellin in the Ardennes reconnoissing with a Gerolsteiner kit. I mean, that... Yeah, in hindsight, so much of that is just so funny, but I don't know what year that would have been, maybe 2005 or something.
No, Gerald Steiner.
He won the trilogy. He got Flesh and Amstel and Liège.
He won the three.
And
the three.
That was in...
Oh, four.
Yeah, but I think this must have been 2005. It was just an ad. It was an ad where he was doing like a solo Gerald Steiner moment. Anyway, I just thought you'd... bit of trivia.
Thanks.
He's been around for a little while.
Yes.
In other words.
A long while.
More than 10 years ago.
He's going out with a blaze of glory.
And Gerolsteiner, another team, which is we won't remember for all the right reasons. Guys, it's been a pleasure. We will wrap this up and we'll see you all next week. For everyone listening at home, thanks for joining us. And for all your news, blogs, videos, pics and more, we're always creating more content at sbs.com.au/cyclingcentral, except for Rob. He doesn't work here. Sorry, Rob. That's it. Bye for now.